I graded. I think I went over most of your homework. I didn't go over all of it. If you didn't do it yet, please get it in. And thank you. So, okay. Why was there cooking going on in the tabernacle? Remember, all the 39 acts of work are activities that went into the building and the maintenance of the tabernacle.
Well, they're talking about making bread.
They had bread. Why did they have bread in the tabernacle? Not the burnt, no, it wasn't an offering. They had these things called the showbreads. And they were basically 12 different loaves, and they were constantly being made. And therefore, there were 11 activities that went into baking bread. And by the way, these are 11 activities that anybody who bakes bread, it's not just Jews who bake bread, anyone who bakes bread has to first make the soil suitable for sowing and plowing and reaping and gathering and threshing and winnowing, selecting, grinding, sifting, kneading, and finally baking. Baking and cooking. Baking is just cooking in regard to bread. But that's basically the malacha. And that's one of the things that we refrain from doing on Shabbat. What I want to try to do with you now for the next few minutes is just give you a definition. What does it mean not to cook on Shabbat? And how can you have hot food on Shabbos if you can't cook? Okay? And this is very important. I'll tell you off the bat quickly. As long as the food is cooked before Shabbos, you can heat it up. Except you have to heat it up in what kind of way?
Hot plate.
You have to use something that's already producing the heat that you're not turning on Shabbat itself. It's pretty self-explanatory. So what are good examples of that? A hot plate. What else?
A crock pot. That says keep warm.
Well, what about just putting it, like, can you leave your stove on?
Yeah.
And then just put the stuff?
You
and
can.
Put the stuff in the...
With those plates covering
You have
the
a thing called a blech on top. I'm going to get to this in a minute. Okay, well, let's just go into it. I'm going to make this class very, very practical, okay? What would be the problem with just opening up the oven and you leave the oven on Shabbat? Let's say you're okay with doing that. You leave a little window open. I don't know. What's the problem with opening up the oven door on Shabbat and just putting your food in there that's already been previously cooked from before Shabbat?
It's going to be hot enough that it's going to continue the cooking process.
Well, let's assume it's fully cooked.
Okay.
Let's assume it's fully cooked. If something is not fully cooked, then cooking a little more is a problem.
Yeah.
That's true. But what's the issue with opening up a stove?
The light will turn on.
Besides the light?
Or the heat, and then I have to get back to temperature.
Okay, good. What happens usually? Is that what you're going to say?
It causes
more fuel to be burned.
Yeah.
Because the cold air comes in, the thermostat reacts, causes more fuel to be burned, and you're opening up the oven is now causing, it's actually not the prohibition of cooking. What's the prohibition?
It's lighting a fire.
Because lighting a fire or increasing a flame, and that's called in Hebrew Havara, is a prohibition on Shabbat, which is why you want to light your candles and it's already Shabbos. What do? Can't. You just don't. You just don't light it. Okay, and by the way, breaking Shabbat on the biblical level is obviously a lot worse than trying to fulfill a rabbinic command, which is lighting the candles, is rabbinic origin, as we've discussed. So that's why you can't really put the food in an oven on Shabbat. But you could put the food on top of an oven, as long as it's not an exposed flame. Anybody know why? As long as you have something over the flame, what is that called?
Blech.
It's called a blech. It's just a piece of sheet metal or something that's over the. Why is that? And this is now we're getting into rabbinics, because the flame is on and the food's already been cooked. And the only way to really violate cooking on Shabbat is to take something which has not been cooked and make it cooked on Shabbat. If it's already been cooked and you're just heating it up, that's not called cooking. That's called heating up, warming it up. That's okay. But why can't I just do it on the open flame?
It's like indirect. It's like why you.
Because you.
My brain's not working well tonight. But it's just with the cup with the hot water.
Why?
The
state.
Well, because it can't come. No, it's I just can't think of it right now. It can't come in like direct contact with the heat source. I think it has to like be sort of.
No, you have to turn on the stove then.
No, the stove is on. Let's say the stove is on from before Shabbat.
The cliche.
I know, but you're conflating this with something else. Let's keep it simple. What's the logical rationale why those sages would say, don't take a piece of chicken or kugel that's already been previously cooked and put it directly on the flame, even though if the flame was kindled before Shabbat, should be okay. What do you think the reason is? Why can't you just take some, and let's say you have a pan that's on the stove. Why can't you just put it right on the open flame?
Because it's going to start overcooking.
It's cooked already.
More.
Well, no, because you're conducting heat from one source to another, right? So if you're putting the pan on, you're putting the pan directly on the flame, right? That direct source is going to emulate the heat.
But then, because
if you have a separation,
are you affecting any change in the pan? Really? What kind of pan is that? If it's affected. No, it's an interesting thing. What's that? But how is it cooking if it's already cooked?
It's already cooked.
Like it's fully cooked.
No, isn't it? It looks like you're cooking.
The rabbis say in bishlach bishl. There's no cooking after cooking.
Yeah.
You can't kill somebody twice. Okay, once somebody's dead, they're already
dead.
You're not killing them a second
from
time.
The cover seeps.
Think about if you were a sage. And you were authorized to enact laws to prevent the laws of the Torah from being violated.
Because you might,
take
something that's not cooked and put it on the.
Okay, that's interesting. That's not what they were concerned about. But keep going. Now you're starting to say it.
If it's not fully cooked, how can you be sure?
But let's. I'm giving you a hypothetical. If it's not fully cooked, it's a problem. Then you're cooking, and then you're dealing something on the biblical level. I'm talking about rabbinics now. I'm talking that the rabbis safeguarded this. Okay, that's number one. It looks like you're cooking, but it's not about other people. One second, Trace. It's not about what other people think. Is that if you get yourself involved in doing something that so closely resembles the prohibited activity, the rabbis are concerned you'll end up doing the prohibited activity itself. It just looks too much like it's cooking.
That's why chicken is meat. That's why
it's actually I'm going to be very technical with you, Jonathan. It's actually not. That's called marasayin.
Okay.
No, you're right. I take that back. You're absolutely right. It is a very good example. It's a very good analogy. Because people mix... I'm sorry, you're right. People mix meat and chicken up. That's why. So it's the same thing. That's number one. In Hebrew, that's called... Take a look on the second page. See, it says rabbinic enactments. Lest... You say that the two concerns. Lest one... Number two, mechsei kimavasha looks as though you're cooking.
Yeah.
Okay, that's one. Now, Henry started saying the other one. What is the concern that you're going to do, that's going to happen? The food is cold. You want to heat it up. And now you put it on there. The concern is what? You might end up adjusting the flame. Why would you adjust the flame? Give me a scenario where you might inadvertently adjust the flame.
To avoid burning the cooked food.
Okay, you don't want to burn it, so you pull it down. And what is the prohibition in adjusting a flame on Shabbat? We just said it. What is it? It's one of the 39 acts of work. It's Havara, which is kindling a flame. You can't turn it down, you can't pull it up. It's one of the 39 acts of work. It's not cooking. So you might turn it down because you want to burn the food, and you might turn it up because why? Because you want it to heat up faster. Because the company is waiting there, they're getting hungry. So like... Okay, so that's what this is a classic rabbinic. So therefore, what's permissible on Shabbat is to take it out of the fridge, heat it up on something, but something that doesn't look like you're cooking, and something that's going to remind you that it's Shabbos, so you won't turn it down or up. And that's called the blech, or the hot plate, or something that's weird about the way you're cooking. You're not supposed to really make up your own weird thing, but I guess you could. But you're supposed to just do it in a unordinary kind of way as a reminder that it's Shabbat so that you don't come to violate Havara. Havara means kindling a flame. Say again? That is weird. And I give you credit for... Yeah. Over what? Tinfoil over what?
Yeah, but sometimes you can burn it too.
I don't know. I don't know if that would. Just try to stick with the blech. Now,
the hot plate
can just be. Here's the thing: if you get a plug-in hot plate, just an on-off, like you plug it in, it goes hot. You pull it out, it goes off. You don't have to put any tinfoil on it. If you get, and I don't want to get too complicated, if you get a low, medium, and high hot plate, and according to many Ashkenazic opinions, not Sephardic, the Sephardim are a little more lenient on this, and according to Ashkenazic opinions, you can only put the food on the periphery. Because according to, I'll give you the rationale, because once you have that low, medium, high, it now is being taken out of the rubric of being a hot plate, according to some rabbis. It's just it looks like a little stove. And a little stove looks like you're cooking when you're just putting it anywhere on there. So that's why I tell people, get a hot plate that is just an on and off. No low, medium, and high. According to Rav Avadya Yosef, who's a former chief rabbi, Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel, as long as it's a hot plate, even if it's low, medium, and high, it's okay. But I'm teaching, I guess.
What does Jill like to use?
She uses a hot plate. It works really well.
Just the plug-in one.
The plug-in one, and we set a timer to it so it's not on all Shabbat.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it gets hot. It gets hot. So I just want to make sure that if you're using a extension cord, that it's a heavy-duty extension cord. Some of those things are not so safe all the time. Just make sure, and you keep nothing around it. Just make sure you keep your kosher kitchen, a safe kosher kitchen.
Mine's actual numbers. You adjust it.
You adjust what?
The hot plate. Like, it's digital with numbers. Like, there's arrows.
So you do it before Shabbat.
Yeah.
Great. That's great. Fancy schmancy.
Yeah, but mine's supposed to cover it.
Oh, you have numbers. That's like low, medium, and high.
Yeah.
Yeah, but mine's actual numbers.
What's that?
It's not a dial. It's
butted. The only thing you could do, I'll give you a little leniency, which is there's a debate as to what constitutes a blech. Some say that a blech covers the heat source. That was Rav Moshe Feinstein's opinion. Others say that the blech should cover the controls. That was Rav Aaron Cutler's opinion. Some people do both. Some people will cover both just with a piece of tinfoil. So what you could do, as long as you cover it, if you cover the dials, then that could maybe prevent you from having to put a piece of tinfoil and only putting the food on the periphery. You should be okay just covering the dials. Just cover it with some tinfoil from before Shabbat.
How about removing the knob?
If you remove the knob, or just cover it with some tinfoil. Right. Is this making sense? I wanted everyone to see that this is like a logical kind of system. It's not hokey pokey. It's like, you know, and you can still get really hot food. What's the one big exception of that I haven't said anything about? The one big exception to everything that I've said. Everything is good as long as the food is fully cooked and it's what kind of food? Solid. Thank you. Because if it's a liquid...
The water...
Yeah.
Then what happens... Because here's the thing. Here's the difference between your liquids and your solids. That's why very few people have soup on Saturday lunch. Most people only have hot soup Friday night because you can't really reheat it. Because reheating chicken or kugel is just reheating it. It's not cooking it. The molecules don't change and reformat themselves so that such that, I'm not explaining this like a good engineer would, such that reheating it would constitute some sort of change in the actual item. But that does apply when it comes to a liquid. Because what is cooking when it comes to a liquid? It's just boiling. It's either boiled or it's not boiled. So when you're heating it up, that's called cooking. So that's why we don't really, none of this applies to liquids. We don't subject liquids to the same rules or leniencies. Meaning, if you have chicken soup or some other kind of liquid that you want to heat up on Shabbat, we don't really do that on Shabbat. We don't take it and put it on the blech or put it on the hot plate. You could put it a little to take the cold out of it. Okay? As long as it's been previously cooked, you can take the chill out of it. But once you get it up to what's called Yad Soledet Bo, Yad Soledet Bo, you touch it, you'd have to recoil. If it's that hot, that's the line that you don't cross. Because that's called cooking. Anything up to Yad Soledet Bo, so just taking the chill out of it is okay. You might see this with a mommy and a baby, and the milk is cold. The mother wants to warm up the milk for her child. So it's okay to take the cold milk out of the fridge in the bottle and put it in a hot water that was boiled from before Shabbat. Even though you're heating up a liquid, the milk is a liquid, but you're not, as long as you pull it out, as long as you pull the bottle of milk out before it gets to Yad Soledet Bo. Yad Soledet Bo's meat, I don't know what temperature that is. Hot enough that if you touch it, you go, wow.
So at what viscosity?
Yeah. There's a debate. That's a very good question. So, everyone hear Tracy's question? So, if you have meatballs and meatballs in sauce, delicious, and you want to heat that up on Shabbos, how do you determine whether or not that is a liquid or a solid? Now, a lot of different opinions. Very strict. Some people, very strict, will just not heat up the liquid at all. They'll just heat up the meatballs. Others will say if it's one piece, if it's one thing, then you just follow 51%. If 51% of the thing is solid, then you can heat it up. Mm-hmm. If 51% of that thing is liquid, then you can't. That's a very lenient opinion, but it's an acceptable opinion. Yes?
For liquids, I guess a few months ago I did go to a home that serves soup.
On Saturday?
Yeah.
Right, so, first of all, you should never talk to them again. I also went to such a home. Maybe it was the same home. And I'm going to check this out a little better for the minority. There is a way of doing it, by the way. It's just, it's very inconvenient, and it, which is that, like, you take the food, and you can leave it in a crock pot. You know, and you just have to keep the food hot enough so that it doesn't go bad. And then if you do that, in other words, as long as you kept it on the crock pot from before Shabbat. So if you have soup, hot boiling soup, and you want to have it on Saturday, you have a thing, you have to have hot boiling soup on Saturday, I guess you could leave it in the crock pot from before the time Shabbat. But you can't take it out and put it back in or anything like that.
Yeah.
You deserve it.
You mess up.
You just leave town.
Just go shopping.
I don't know, like a witness protection program, I think.
Oh.
Change your name. Stuff happens, man. I mean, I'm serious. Like, it's real. Like, people mess up. That's how I know people are actually keeping Shabbos, when they call me and tell me this happened. Because that's real. That's what happens. You mess up. You put a light on by accident. You heat something up you weren't supposed to heat up. But such is life. Hashem understands. I mean, as long as we're trying and we're trying to do our best and we're not being careless. Mm-hmm. We're not being careless. Because I think I said this last week, we do have sacrifices that were brought for people who did something accidentally. Now, why would you bring a sacrifice for committing a sin by accident? You didn't do it on purpose. So you still did it. It still tainted the soul. But I think the other answer is that there's an assumption that if we were more careful, we may not have messed up. So it's always easy to say, it was an accident. But, you know, sometimes we pull the lens back and we say, okay, but accidents more often than not happen when we are not as careful as we otherwise should be. But just keep asking questions and don't worry about that. It just happens. A lot of people are very, I'm not going to kosher my kitchen because I may trafe it up. Okay, you trafe it up, we'll fix it again. You can't live life like that. You know? So it's a great question.
A hot water urn is okay?
So let's talk about that. Hot water urn is because I had this problem here at MGE. I can't even tell you how many weeks. I'd come in and I'd see the hot water urn here for the coffee and the tea, and I would say, Jerry, I don't remember anyone putting that up before Shabbat. He goes, no, I just boiled the water this morning. Yeah. I said, thanks, Jerry. Pour out the water, we can't. Yeah. And that's the next class about to what degree can you rely on non-Jewish help. That's why I wanted to get into that soon. But I was like, you have to, as long as you boil the water from before Shabbat, it's fine.
Okay.
The only thing you want to do is when you want to have tea or coffee, you have to be a little concerned that what? That even though the water's boiled before Shabbat, there are certain types of materials that are in Hebrew called kali habishul, easily cookable. Tea leaves are a classic example. You don't have to do much to cook tea leaves. Put a little hot water, bam. Okay, red meat, like a steak, like a raw meat, you need a lot of heat for that. You need very little, like, you know, different things. That's why a steak will take a good hour to cook from a raw state, you know, as opposed to tea, which in 2 seconds. So when it comes to what's called kali habishul, which is easily cooked items, thin fish, that kind of thing, we want to make sure that we're not cooking them, even though the water is coming from another source. So you have your urn. Your urn is called your first vessel. That's the vessel in which the water was boiled, cooked. And then you want to have some tea. So if you put your tea bag in the cup, and you put the cup underneath, and you open up the water, and the hot water comes right onto the tea bag, what are you doing?
Cooking.
You're cooking. Even though the water was already boiled from before Shabbat, you're undoing the water to, so it could come out,
mm-hmm.
Is causing those tea leaves to be cooked. So there is a... now, the Talmud does say, klisheni eni mevashel, that second vessels don't have the capacity to cook. Second vessels don't have the capacity to cook, but we make exception to that exception for easily cooked items, and therefore we require a third vessel. So how do you make tea or coffee on Shabbos? Very simple. You have your previously boiled water. You guys know how to previously boil water? Not that complicated. You got an urn or something. You could theoretically keep it in a kettle on a blech. We used to do that when I grew up. We always had like a... my mom used to have like just a kettle, and it was on the blech. And...
whistle.
What's that?
Doesn't it whistle?
It would whistle, you know, whatever. And it would just... It would be there all Shabbat for us to have tea. But when we made the tea, she actually used tea essence, which some people are very, very strict. And then I realized that it was following an opinion that we didn't have to follow, whatever it is. But that's the way we grew up. We had tea essence. You know what tea essence is?
You made the tea before.
You made the tea. You just take like three or four tea bags together, pour hot water. It's like concentrated tea. Then you have the hot water, and you just pour a little of that concentrated tea in. That's another way of doing it. Most people just use tea bags, and that's perfectly acceptable. Just don't put the tea bag in the cup.
So
put the hot water in a cup. That's kli rishon. First vessel is the urn, right, or the tea kettle, whatever it was cooked in. The second vessel is the cup, and then pour from the cup into another cup, and then dip your tea bag into that other cup. That's called kli shlishi. Kli is a vessel. Three, vessel one is the water is cooked in it. Vessel two is the water gets poured from vessel one into vessel two. And then vessel three, the water gets poured from vessel two to vessel three, and then you dip the tea in that. That's how you have tea on Shabbos.
Wait,
or coffee.
But can you open?
One second.
Cooking.
So it's really not. And that's a very good, I know exactly what you're asking. It's a really good question. Because those tea leaves still look like they're getting cooked, and the tea tastes like tea. So haven't I cooked? It's a really good question. No, you haven't. Not according to halacha. It's its own system.
Can you open the tea bag?
Why would you want to open the tea bag?
Because that's how the tea bags are. Like, you have to open the seal.
You have to tear it?
No, that's okay. As long as you don't tear through lettering, you're okay. You can tear it open. You can tear up open any
tea. You have everything written on
there.
Why not?
There's a lot of stuff written on the tea.
No, it's fine.
But you're tearing more electricity. Like, would you even be able to eat hot food?
They didn't have hot food on Shabbos. Yeah, they had a fire. Yeah, they had these old, the Talmud talks about these old, they're called tanurim. A tanur was like an ancient oven. And basically it was a fire, and people would come and stick their food in it. And you couldn't use it was fire.
It was like
same principles.
Coal oven, like a...
Coal or fire. Yeah, they had hot food on Shabbat. The cholent is actually a very interesting history to it, the whole idea of having cholent on Shabbat. Because it's like a slow cooking thing.
Mm-hmm.
The reason cholent became famous. Anybody know why cholent became famous?
No.
Because it was the rabbi's way of trying to respond to the Karaites. You know who the Karaites were?
Mm-hmm.
Karaites were those who never accepted the oral tradition. They read the Bible literally. Jews. I have a friend who's a self-professed Karaite. And we argue. He's a brilliant guy, but he's totally off. I'm not going to say who he is. And they read the Torah literally. And what does the Torah say? The Torah says, "Lo savaru esh b'chol moshavotechem." Do not kindle a flame in your precincts. They read it in such a way that you can't have a flame in your precincts. You can't have a fire. We know that means you can't kindle a flame on Shabbat. But you can have it if it was kindled before Shabbos. Now, you only know that if you have an oral tradition. You also only know, as I said to him, that we don't pluck out a person's eye if they take out another person's eye. Because we have an oral tradition that tells us it means monetary damage, is not an eye for an eye, literally. Okay? And I don't know, he has some sort of justification how they wouldn't do that either. I'm like, either you really read it literally, or you know, you can't have your cake and eat it too, I say. So they wouldn't have hot food in there. They would sit in dark homes on Shabbos, because they said you can't have a fire in your home. The Karaites sat in dark homes. Also, they'd also have, the husbands and wives would literally live, in, when a woman went into Nida, the husband and wife would literally live in separate homes. Because they were reading certain verses literally. You'd leave, your Judaism would be a radically different Judaism if you read the Torah literally. It'd also be very barbaric for other reasons. But, and so the slow cooking stuff was like a way of the rabbis responding to the Karaites, that we are interpreting the Torah according to the oral tradition, which says as long as you don't kindle the flame on Shabbat itself, you're okay. So that's what we're doing, basically. We're trying to enjoy Shabbos, have hot food. The other thing you can't really... Now, you may be able to ask about the soup. There might be opinions within the Sephardic world that say there is cooking, there is no cooking after cooking applying to liquids too. And therefore, if soup was cooked before Shabbat and it cooled down, there might be a basis, according to some Sephardic halachic decisors, to reheat the soup, just like you can reheat a solid piece of chicken or kugel. But don't take me on that just yet. I'm going to do a little more research on it.
Question. Yeah. Do you use closed-end high-pressure systems? Can you manipulate temperature to the point, specifically of...
As long as you're not doing it yourself on Shabbos.
Right, but you can... But in for example, if you use a very high-pressure system, you can make water go 300 degrees.
Yeah, you can make that water go as hot as you want. Yeah. It's not about hot, it's about you doing it on Shabbat. And then what is it that... It's all about our activities. You see what we're doing? We're just becoming... We're fine-tuning our activities on Shabbat. All right. Any other questions about... So stovetop, electric hot plate, crock pot. Also, how many of you guys make cholent on Shabbat? Anybody here? No cholent? All right, I don't need to tell you this. Just a little trick if you have cholent, that's all. All right, let's talk a little about non-Jewish help. If we have a few minutes. We have 15 minutes. We're moving and grooving. I've never done this. What's that? It's just you really should have a blech on your crock pot also. So you just take a piece of tinfoil and line between the metal part and then the ceramic part. You just line it with some. Or cover it, like I told you before. You can just cover your, where you have the controls, where you see the digital, All right. So, according to the Torah itself, this is a great example, by the way. What we just did about cooking, there's a biblical element, there's a rabbinic element. What's the biblical element? Don't cook on Shabbos. The rabbinic stuff is you might come to do this, that, and the other. This is all rabbinic, and I'm using this as an example of all rabbinic. Because according to the Torah itself, if you wanted to ask somebody who isn't Jewish to do something for you on Shabbos, is that a problem?
No.
Right? Or if you want to set a timer, you don't have to be that creative. You can get everything done for you without you doing anything yourself, and you won't have broken one rule. So the rabbis came along for three different reasons, and they said, no, we don't want that. We don't want Jews relying on non-Jews on Shabbat. Why? Three possibilities. Number one, Maimonides, the Rambam. So Shabbos will not be taken lightly. What does that mean? So Shabbos will not be taken lightly. What do you think?
If it's too easy, then...
What happened to Josh? Did I insult him?
He's gone for a while.
Oh, I hope he's
you
okay.
Just noticed that. Mm-hmm.
It's okay.
Is that his umbrella?
Everything's
Jackson.
Yeah, I'm not sure what happened. You might want to check on him. Is he
I'll text him. It's a big boy. So wait, what does that mean? I just don't want him to miss this, that's all. Because I was talking to him about one of these things.
He's
wearing the
invisibility code.
I don't think I could go into the
men's room. What does that mean, Shabbat not taken lightly?
Not taken...
So Shabbos... The rabbis came along and they said, don't rely on... By the way, there's so many exceptions to this rule. I'm going to run through the exceptions. But I want to give you the rule first, okay? The rule is not supposed to rely on non-Jewish help on Shabbat. Three different theories as to why. so that Shabbos should not be taken lightly. What do you think that means?
If it's too easy, then you don't really feel the sanctity of the holiday.
Yeah, and what else? Think very practically, like you were saying to say before about the cooking stuff. Because if you start getting used to stuff happening on Shabbat, and right. when your non-Jewish friend's not around, what might happen? You just end up doing yourself because you're always used to having that light on or that thing being cooked or whatever it is. So you end up just doing it yourself. Okay? Two, Rashi says, you guys know who Rashi, the great biblical commentator. Yeah. Rashi says, no, it's nothing to do with that. It's part of the things you're not supposed to speak about on Shabbat. You know that? That there's actually a category of speech that is forbidden on Shabbos. It's learned out from the prophets. We're not supposed to talk business on Shabbos. We're mm-hmm. supposed to make deals on Shabbat. Even though I had one, it's a really cute story, and I'll tell you another time. For the forbidden speech, so Rashi says, one of the things that's forbidden speech on Shabbat is telling someone else to do something which otherwise is forbidden for you to do. That's the speech you want to stay away from. Not only do you want to stay away from doing, you know, malachot on Shabbat, you want to even not talk about them. And by telling a non-Jew, hey, buddy, can you do me a favor? Put that light on. Push that elevator button for me, whatever it is. It's a problem, right? That's Rashi's theory. The third theory is called, in English, agency, or in Hebrew, shlichut. And we have this in secular also. Tom, if I ask you to deliver something on my behalf, what are you vis-a-vis me? I appoint you as my messenger, and I ask you to deliver something. So you are, the Talmud says, shlucho shel adam kamoso, that a shaliach, a messenger, is an extension. You're an extension. So if I ask my fellow non-Jew, can you put that light on? In a sense, it's like I did it because I put them up to it. Those are the three theories. And based on that, I want you to plug it in on the bottom. Take a look at the four prohibitions, and you can see which one. You got all three, guys? You with me? Mm-hmm. Number one, so Shabbos is not taken lightly. Number two, forbidden speech. Number three, agency. So number one, we're not supposed to ask a fellow non-Jew to perform a malacha. Why? Any one of the things above. So you don't take Shabbos lightly. Forbidden speech, agency. What about asking a non-Jew on Shabbos to do something for you after Shabbos? You bump into your friend on a Saturday morning and say, hey, do me a favor, 10 o'clock at night, Shabbos is out, can you please do this? Is that a problem?
Yeah.
Which one is it a problem?
Speech. Yeah.
Which one? Speech? And what else?
The forbidden
part. Forbidden speech? And then, so Shabbat will not be taken lightly? It's not happening for you on Shabbos, so that doesn't
mind
apply.
Is on non-Shabbos related activities.
Like okay, but try to plug it into these three.
Agency.
It might be agency. Well, agency for what?
Because you could technically do it on Shabbat after.
You could do it yourself after Shabbat also, so it's not agency. It's just forbidden speech. Okay, good. That's two. Three, asking a non-Jew on a weekday. Today's Wednesday. You see your non-Jewish friend, and you're like, do me a favor. I want you to come over on Saturday at about 10 in the morning. Put the lights on for me.
That's okay.
Okay?
That's okay.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. Well, it says prohibition includes, but I feel like...
No, okay. So, wait a minute. Let's go through each one. Number one. So, Shabbos will not be taken lightly. Yep. It applies. Because that guy's coming into your home and putting a light on in your home, and you're getting used to having light in your home. It's not forbidden speech because you can say it on Wednesday. It's only Wednesday. And it's not agency because you're putting them up to it on Wednesday. I don't know about the agency thing. Wait, let's just finish this, then I'll answer your question. What about benefiting from a lacha performed by a non-Jew on his own initiative? And this happens all the time. You're sitting in a room. Your friend knows you're one of these crazy Sabbath observant Jews. He sees you sitting in the dark. So he's a nice guy. He puts the light on for you.
That's okay.
Is it?
Well, yeah.
It says prohibition includes. So you know it's not okay, but why?
Walk away.
One, two, or three.
Walk away.
Yeah, you have to leave technically.
Yeah, you have to leave.
Oh, you do?
You can't stay in the room.
One for sure.
What's that? But I have a trick. What's that?
One,
Shabbos not taking light. It's not forbidden speech. You didn't say anything. You didn't put him up to it. And it's not agency because you didn't ask him to do it. It's just one. So what do you do? It's a little trick. So you technically have to get up and leave. Or if that person comes in and sits down and reads and they need the light, so you're just benefiting from something they're doing for themselves. That's called a date d'nafshin. It's one of the big exceptions. If the non-Jew is doing the activity, not for you, they're doing it for themselves, and you just are benefiting from something that they're doing for themselves. But it's got to really be for themselves. And I'll give you some examples. So you're in a kosher hotel for Passover. You're joining me at the PGA this Passover. It's very reasonably priced.
BGA.
It's not. Nah. It's ridiculous.
I used to go there.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Right, I don't play golf either. Whatever. So the waiter comes over with a pen and a little pad and says, "Mark, what do you want for lunch?" And you say, "I'd like the potato leek soup." And they write, "Potato leek soup, Wilds. Table 5. Can you do that?
No.
Yes.
Well, yeah.
His own,
aren't they writing?
They are writing.
They need it for themselves.
They're not Jewish, so they can write.
They're writing.
They're going to forget. So
they're going to forget the writings themselves. If this person had a better memory, he or she would not be asking, would not be writing it down. They would just, or they run back and forth if they have a really bad memory. They're only writing it down for their own convenience. That's called in Hebrew adate denafshe, which means their adate means their das, their knowledge, their mindset is on nafshe, on themselves. But it doesn't apply to things that you could easily add to, like coffee. So it's like we had this woman helping us with our kids when they were little, Medina. We're still very close with her. She's a religious Muslim woman, actually, and she lived with us for a while, and she loved all of this stuff. Okay, but she'd make a cup of coffee on Shabbos, and then all of a sudden she'd hand Jill a cup of coffee. And Jill's like, she's like, "I did it for me. I was making coffee anyway." But that doesn't work, because anything that you would have to add a little, put a little more water in the soup, that doesn't apply.
Right.
The example given in the Talmud is that someone builds a bridge for themselves. A non-Jew builds a bridge. The Jew can walk over the bridge. They're not building more bridges for the Jews. Mm-hmm. But coffee, they got to put more. They got to cook more coffee for you. So it doesn't apply. So it's a very technical kind of thing.
Technically,
yeah.
Like whenever I make tea or coffee,
yes,
I end up putting in way more water than I actually need for
Right.
So couldn't they also sort of say,
maybe, but categorically we don't do it. You know, that's true. It could be, you know, you could be a weird guy and have big eyes, but that we can't rely on that.
Like,
yeah.
She does
for that,
online,
I still have
so. Yeah.
Question
yeah.
For this one. Say, not that they really would share drinks, but say you're like...
Ah, that's interesting. If they really made it for themselves,
yeah,
you could have a sip
like,
of their coffee.
Yeah.
You could then have a sip of their coffee. They could even pour you a little. That's true. That's very, very good. Very good.
So
wait, 1 second, and then, yeah?
Elevators.
I'm going to get to elevators.
Yeah.
So,
what about Jerry?
Your question, yeah, I want to hear about that.
I wish Jerry was in the elevator.
But your
go ahead.
You were saying how, oh, like, on a Wednesday, you asked so-and-so to come to you at 10 a.m.
Yeah.
Okay. So, like, I went to Buffalo for grad school, and the Chabad family had their housekeepers come on
Shabbat. Sure.
Yeah, but, like, not from the beginning. Like, they come to just... literally do their, like, weekly clean on Shabbat.
The only thing that they can do for you is anything you could do yourself, just another pair of hands.
Okay.
You understand? Just because you're hiring, just because they're not Jewish doesn't mean that they could start doing malachot for you that they otherwise can't. So the only exception, does anyone follow that?
Yeah.
If you're hiring help on Shabbat and they happen not to be Jewish, so they can do all the things that you can do. But you can't have them start and do things that would otherwise be a violation for you to do. That's called non-Jewish help on Shabbat. That's forbidden by the rabbis. The only thing is, and there's some exceptions, you drop your shirt off at the cleaners on Friday. Okay? And you say, "I'm going to come on Monday and pick it up." And the cleaner decides to clean your shirt on Saturday, on Shabbat. Was that forbidden?
No.
Why not?
It's in their possession.
It's in their possession, but what? Come on.
You didn't direct them to do it on Saturday.
You are benefiting it. You're getting the stuff cleaned, and it's being cleaned on Shabbos. You guys follow the example? You drop off your dress, your shirt before Shabbos. I'll be here on Monday to pick it up. And they, what's that? They could have done it on Sunday. The fact that they did it on Saturday was that, as long as you didn't say, "I want you to do this on Saturday," or you drop it off so close to Shabbat and say, "I'm going to come Saturday night and pick it up," and you give them no window to do it other than Shabbat, then that is basically, that would be prohibited. So if you have hired help and they want to catch up on some other work, they could, you know, and they're doing it on their own. You didn't put them up to do it on Shabbat, and they go to some other room and they start ironing some shirts, which you can't really have your non-Jewish help do on Shabbat. But they want to just catch up on some stuff they have to do anyway. They can go into the other room and do it because they're doing it really for their own convenience. Even though they're doing it for you, their choice to do it on Shabbat is for them. You follow?
You can still set, okay, not people related, but you can still set like an alarm before Shabbat.
Yeah, so this has nothing to do with timers and all that. There's no controversy with timers. You can literally set anything on a timer.
Okay.
It's not in the spirit of Shabbat to set a timer to put a movie on, something like that, but it's not really forbidden. It's not, because you're not doing it. There is only a category of prohibition for a human being, a non-Jew. By the way, it goes without saying that you can't ask a Jew. Oh, he's not Sabbath observant. What does he care? Can't do that. You cannot ask a fellow Jew to do anything for you on Shabbat, even if they don't observe the Sabbath anyway.
So what about the water?
So we couldn't use it those weeks that I found out that he boiled it on Shabbat.
Bahan, why? If he did it, he's not doing it.
What do you mean?
Oh,
what do you mean? So, what was your question?
That he's not a Jewish person.
Right.
So he couldn't.
But he was doing it for us.
For our
yeah, but
he was. He boiled the water for our tea and coffee for Cafe Connect.
Gotcha.
He did it for us.
But he wasn't asked.
But I want to go through the. It doesn't matter.
What about
even if he wasn't asked? Same. You're sitting in the room. I'm going to get the elevator in a minute. Now follow with me real quick. You guys ready? Look at the second page. You guys know the rule now. Basically, it's pretty general. We don't rely on non-Jewish help on Shabbat, except if they're doing it for their own thing, and I got more exceptions. For a mitzvah, you can ask a non-Jew on Shabbat to do something that otherwise would be forbidden on the rabbinic level. I'm going to get really technical. I need you guys to focus for a minute, okay? You can ask a non-Jew to do something that would otherwise be only rabbinically forbidden for you to do, if it was a mitzvah.
Such as what?
Such as taking an elevator on Shabbos. If you yourself were to push the button on Shabbat and do the elevator, what kind of violation would you be in?
Using electricity.
Is that biblical or rabbinic?
Rabbinic.
It's rabbinic.
Yeah.
Electricity without heat or light is rabbinic. If it involves heat or light, it becomes biblical. Mm-hmm. Since it does, there's no heat or light. You'll say a little light goes on when you push the button. And those few instances when the elevator is working and the light goes on, or it does produce some heat, that's incidental. You're not pushing the button to produce light or heat. You're pushing the button to get the elevator to come up for you. So that's why if you were to push the button yourself, it's only rabbinically forbidden. Asking a non-Jew to do something which is otherwise rabbinically forbidden for you on Shabbat is okay when there's a mitzvah involved. So you're going up here for what reason? Why are you coming up to MG? Either to meet your soulmate, mitzvah, to eat food, mitzvah, pray, mitzvah, all that stuff are mitzvah, okay? Yeah. The soulmate is maybe a little loosey-goosey, but, okay, now, that's the reason why. Now, I once asked a big rabbi with 40 other rabbis in the room, Rav Herschel Schechter, not Rabbi Schechter from last night, Rav Herschel Schechter is one of the great poskim of our generation, and I said, Rabbi, I'm on the 10th floor of this building, and like they're Gesunta flights. You know, they're like it's an old building, so look at the ceilings here. You know, it's like walking 15 flights. So I said it should be okay for us to rely on non-Jewish help because of what's called Shvut, Shvut B'Makom Mitzvah. Rabbinic, cancels out when there's a mitzvah. You got the two rabbinics. Rabbinic number one is if you push the button yourself, right, because electricity without heat or light. It's only rabbinically forbidden. Rabbinic number two, asking a non-Jew on Shabbat to do something otherwise forbidden. And the mitzvah, praying, eating, whatever. So he said, yeah, technically it's permissible. And I said, good. And I breathed. I was like, but to do it every Shabbos. He says, to rely on a heter, a leniency, every Shabbos is not so great. I said, welcome to Manhattan. So that's why once in a while I'll try to walk up. But it's technically okay. Does anyone follow why? Because you're asking a non-Jew to do something which is otherwise rabbinically forbidden for you to do, and that's okay when there's a mitzvah at stake.
But the person that's hired here on Shabbat, like, you don't ask them, I'm going to the temple.
Doesn't matter.
They know.
It's not about asking. Remember.
Mm-hmm.
Remember one of the categories, I should have dwelt on this, but thank you for bringing it up. If you're sitting in a room and it's dark and somebody puts the light on, why is it you have to leave now?
Because
you're benefiting. It's not simply, right. A lot of people, I didn't say anything to him. Our non-Jewish friends are very smart people. They figure out pretty quickly what they need to do to get you your light. Okay,
mm-hmm.
It's all about benefiting from the light. It's not simply that they said something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Rashi, you're correct according to Rashi. Rashi, it's all about the speech. That's why the hinting thing came in, because of Rashi.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I hint him and I didn't really say it, then I'm kind of getting around it. But you're still getting the benefit. Mm-hmm. That's the most important
thing.
Wait,
but then you're hiring a help to help you, you know, whatever.
You're allowed to hire help on Shabbat.
I know, but like...
As long as what you're hiring them to do
and
is...
And you explained it to them before Shabbat. Of course. What needs to be done.
Right.
And then they do it.
Yeah.
To benefit you.
Which is okay, as long as they're not doing a malacha. An actual malacha.
And so then
or, but if they are doing a malacha, it's okay if it's a malacha which is on the rabbinic level,
yeah,
and they're doing it for you, and there's a mitzvah at stake.
So I can tell the doorman ahead of time on Shabbos, and when I get to the, like, they know. I don't say a word, I just smile, and they know exactly what
it
to
depends
do.
If why you're going up to your apartment. You do need a mitzvah reason to go up to your apartment. You can't just go up there stamazoi. Now, there is a mitzvah reason. To take a nap on Shabbos is a mitzvah.
Okay.
It's onek okay. Shabbos. To learn Torah up there.
Okay.
Just to go up there because I just feel like going up there is not enough reason. You should take the steps. You should take the steps then.
Okay. Yeah. I would learn Torah.
There has to be some sort of reason or other or else. You know. All right.
I wonder how people live on like a 40th floor.
Don't you? I'm just telling you in general. I'm not saying we frown, but we strongly discourage people from living on a high floors because of this. The bigger issue that's coming up in most apartment buildings is not this. Because a lot of these buildings, if you have a doorman, they'll push the button for you. And that's okay. As long as you're going up for some mitzvah, and there's a lot of mitzvahs that you could be. Mm-hmm. So the problem is when you get into the hallway, the nice religious Jews trying to go into the hallway now, the lights are going on.
So, oh, we know, but they're on all the time.
No, they're not on. They're on when they sense you there.
Some of them. The sensors, yeah, but like most of them are on. Like
okay,
yeah.
All right. So the better buildings shouldn't be living in such a building. Should live in a building that's trying to conserve. Shame on you now. But yes.
So what do you do?
What about the staircase where the light is sensored?
That's what I'm talking
on.
About. Right.
Oh,
right.
No. Okay.
That's the problem. I don't know. So, like. Some say do it with a shinoi. You know what a shinoi is?
No.
You like do it in a weird way because anytime you do something on Shabbat, you're only violating on the biblical level when you're doing it deliberately, intentionally, and in a normative fashion. If you're righty and you use your left hand, then you've just knocked it down a notch. It's still not great, but it's better. That's why you'll see people doing the elevator
oh, the
button
elbow.
Like this. Yeah. That doesn't make it permissible, but
or
it makes
backpack.
It a little less forbidden. It does, because it's sort of knocking it down a little. Isn't this fun?
Yeah.
Okay, a little more. Hefsed merubah, to prevent substantial financial loss. You can ask a non-Jew. Here's a good example. Your air conditioner is about to blow up because it's frozen over, and if you don't turn that sucker off, it's going to be toast by the time Shabbos is done. It's going to cost you $300 to replace. You can ask a non-Jew to turn off your air conditioner. To prevent, because turning off the air conditioner, again, if you were to do it yourself, is only a rabbinic prohibition, right? It's only a rabbinic prohibition, and you can ask a non-Jew to do something which would otherwise be rabbinically prohibited when there's substantial financial loss. Can't be like for $10, but for $300, yeah. Make sense?
Yeah, it's a good thing that they don't trade on Saturdays on Wall Street.
Why?
You know, it's like, oh no, I need you to
right.
You know,
do this for me. Right. Considerable pain. What does that mean, considerable pain? Something is bothering you and you want some ointment and you have no ointment in your home. You can ask your non-Jewish friend to go to the drugstore and tell him where the money is. Can you do me a favor or I'll pay you back after Shabbos? Can you go buy me this ointment? This is really bothering me. I'm not talking about life-threatening situation. Life-threatening situation, you do it yourself. You don't rely on non-Jews. Okay? But this is talking about, like, you're in pain. It's really upsetting you. It's messing up your Shabbos. You can ask your non-Jewish friend to do this. Covet of Rias, I love this one. Human dignity. You're allowed to ask a non-Jew to do something which would otherwise be rabbinically forbidden for you to do to preserve your human dignity. Here's an example. You walk into MGE. On Shabbat, and the car, big truck, splashes disgusting New York City water all over you, and you look like a mess. And you can't, and you don't live in the city. You came, you don't know where you park. You could go. You could ask somebody, you know, to purchase for you. You can't do it yourself. You could ask a non-Jew to get you a new set of clothing. You know, to actually go to the store and buy the clothing if you needed, or you're in the bathroom. You're in the bathroom, there's no toilet paper, you know, something like that. You want to maintain some human dignity. All right, now, these are leniences on the rabbinic level, which means those are things you can ask a non-Jew to do that would otherwise be only rabbinically forbidden. The next six are when it would be biblically forbidden for you to do. I'll give you an example. Settling the land of Israel. It's a mitzvah to live in Israel. God bless you. It's one of the 613 mitzvot to live in Israel. Let's say the only way you could do that is by asking a non-Jew to do something. What kind of scenario is that? This happened. The cook, the first chief rabbi of Israel, was asked this question. Some of the Arab landowners would purposely conduct their land auctions on Shabbat so that Jews wouldn't buy up land in Israel. And Rav Kook permitted them to be driven. Driving on Shabbos is biblically forbidden. To have a non-Jew, ironically, they'd have to find an Arab. It's the only non-Jews in the Middle East. Okay, and
non-Jews can drive you.
The non-Jew could drive the Jew to the land auction on Shabbat because it is fulfilling the mitzvah of settling the land of Israel. And you're allowed to ask a non-Jew to do something which would otherwise be biblically forbidden if it's to settle the land of Israel. Number two is twilight. This is really interesting. Anybody know what I'm doing?
Twilight zone.
What's twilight? When is twilight? It's about 30, 40 minutes between the sun sets and then the stars come out. It's dark. That 30, 40 minute period is a debate amongst the great sages. Does it belong to the day before or the next day? Because of that debate, there's a little wiggle room with non-Jewish help on Shabbat. You can ask a non-Jew during twilight, which is right when Shabbos starts, for the next 30 minutes after Shabbos started, and then the 30 minutes before Shabbos ends. You could ask a non-Jew to do something for you on Shabbat, because it's a twilight zone. And it may not be Shabbos. Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The thing about asking someone to like drive somebody in the car is, from what I've heard,
this is very limited circumstance. We're talking about like to settle the land of Israel.
Yeah, because like with the air conditioner example, you're asking someone to do something for you, and you're not doing it. But whenever you're getting in the car, doesn't that change the function of the car? Because you're adding so much more weight.
But I don't know if cars operate like that necessarily. That is, by the way, an argument. What you just said, Matt, is an argument that some people make about using the elevator on Shabbat. That even if you can get away with non-Jewish help on Shabbat, you should still not use it, some say, because your added weight is causing more. Ironically, it only does that on the way down, not up, which is better for us, because we're more apt to use it on the way up.
Yeah.
That some elevators operate that your added weight is causing more energy to be expended by the elevator, and therefore, even if the person who's operating the elevator is a non-Jew, it's still an issue. It's more of a minority strict opinion that I don't think you have to follow, but some people say, I've never heard that about a car, though, that the reason you can't be driven in a car in Shabbat is because... The main reason, I think, is non-Jewish help on Shabbat. Also, you have to be careful when the doors open, the lights come on, and that you're causing that to happen. You need someone else to do that. I do tell people, by the way, that if a person is not observant in Shabbat and they're driving themselves, I have told people, try to have somebody else drive you. You're definitely knocking things down very significantly. You're now not involved in breaking Shabbat on the biblical level. You're still breaking the spirit of Shabbat, and you're still in violation of non-Jewish help on Shabbat because the non-Jew is driving you, but you're not involved in combustion, which is a biblical prohibition on Shabbat. So I've told people that. Not to give license.
It's just
this crazy storm.
It's just nuts, man. It's raining for like, it's like a flood out there. 3 days. What's that?
You take the bus.
So taking the bus, by the way, taking the bus on Shabbat is a problem because of non-Jewish help on Shabbat.
No, but
it's better than driving yourself.
In the Hampton Synagogue,
yeah.
Because I've been, they have that bus that goes around.
Is it electric?
They have like a shuttle bus.
No,
like the shul pays for it.
No, the shul is.
Yeah.
There's a difference between an electric car and a non-car.
Big time. Big time.
So like a Tesla. What's the exception?
I doubt that the shul organizes this.
Oh, ask my friend. I've been on it though.
Is it an Orthodox synagogue?
Yeah, Rabbi Schneer or whatever.
Schneier, I know him.
Yeah, I met him.
I would be very surprised unless it's a grumma. They have a grumma there. I told you about this organization that creates like wheelchairs for people that are wheelchair bound. That get around.
Yeah,
so maybe it's a grumma thing. It is better. That's why taking a train on Shabbos is preferable to a bus.
This bus just opened its doors every so often. Like, you didn't tell them what to
stop.
Hold on, I'm going to ask my friend.
I want to make sure Rabbi Pinney's coming
down.
It's a
magic carpet.
That would actually be okay, like taking an escalator technically.
Yeah.
On Shabbat, it's running without you. It's not expending more. It's technically okay.
Rabbi Pinney
Rosenbaum.
So
okay.
How is it electric vehicle because it's not?
So electric vehicle should probably be okay.
Really?
Not for you to do, but for a non-Jew to operate, and you get in it, and if you're coming for Shabbos, or you're coming for a mitzvah. So think about it. It's no different than an elevator, and that's no different than a train. It's not working harder because of you. I mean, that's why you have to be... I'll just take your question in a second. I just want to say one thing. You don't have to be that creative to figure out a way of getting around this stuff. You just want to make sure we don't kill the whole spirit and sanctity of the day because that could go very quickly. That's why my rabbi was against putting an Erev up in our neighborhood in Queens. He got outvoted anyway. But he was nervous that people would start just forgetting about it. But at the end of the day, the Arabs have really enabled more people to come to shul and help more Jews observe Shabbat. The concern is that if you rig your whole home with non-Jews, non-Jewish friends, and timers, so that everything is just getting done and you're... But, I mean, I'm going to deal with this in the hotel over Passover. We're going to have the keys and all this stuff. And so I do think that's why you have to speak to someone. Is it enhancing Shabbat? That's really what you want. And some of the stuff does enhance Shabbat when you have a little of a loophole. It makes it easier to observe Shabbat. Yeah, Maddie.
Is going to a family member's wedding a good enough event?
I was
going to
ask you that.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
No. I'll tell you why. First of all, you're not supposed to get married on Shabbat. Now, that doesn't mean you can't go to the wedding.
What if it's a non-Jewish person?
Right, okay. So, I mean, but you need a mitzvah. There's no mitzvah for you to be there. It's a lovely thing to do. I'm not telling you not to go. And Joe and I have done this over the years where we'll stay in some hotel as close as possible and walk over and, you know, do your hair beforehand and try to, you know, minimize your Shabbat violations and still go to the wedding. You can do that on Shabbat. You can be around the music. Try not to throw yourself into pictures unless 51% of the people in the frame are not Jewish. whatever, there's a handbook of doing this. You could do it.
Okay.
But I wouldn't think that's a basis to be able to be driven there. Because there's no technical. You need a real mitzvah, you know, for that. You are here. Good. Excellent. One last thing I'll mention, and that is the possibility of widespread transgression. It would be permissible on Shabbat to ask a non-Jew to fix an eruv that broke on Shabbat. Now, what's involved in fixing the eruv? This guy's going to have to get in the car. He's going to have to take his wrench and go up on a ladder and do all these things that otherwise would be biblical prohibitions. But it's okay to do that. Why? Because that person is stopping other people from violating Shabbat because people are already carrying probably. And if you don't fix it on Shabbos, then all these Jews that are trying to keep Shabbat will not be keeping Shabbat. That makes sense? I cannot believe we pulled this off. You guys are a very motivated, smart group. I'm serious. It always took me at least two classes to do both of these. Does this make sense? Or is this just like a lot of rules and crazy laws jumping all over the place? All right, next week we're going to jump into the philosophy and ideology of Pesach. Rabbi Pinney is going to start with you guys a little as well. Please stay dry and safe. The air conditioning's on. I'm going to turn it off.
Oh, have you had a chance?
It is cold.
This, show on Netflix about Moses.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Oh, you know who's in
that.
It? It's crazy. Rabbi Einhorn is in it, and his daughter was spending Shabbat with us last weekend. And she stayed Saturday night, and she's like, my dad is in a Netflix thing on Moses.
Yeah.
So I put it on.
Which one is he?
I watched the rabbi.
There's a reformed female rabbi.
There's him, and then there's...
Okay.
Gosh. There's a reform, and then there's like a lot of Christian. There's a Muslim.
He's a Muslim.
So I, have you? I saw two episodes.
The first episode.
I thought it was pretty good.
I watched two episodes too.
What did you guys think?
I fell asleep.
Is it accurate?
No, not everything. A few, but it's pretty good. Pretty good.
It's pretty closer now.
It brings it to life, and I like that. I mean, it's educational because they have other people speaking, you know. But I don't know. I think it'd be much more powerful and dramatic if they didn't have commentators. If they just did the story.
The story is so good.
I don't need everybody's.
Yeah.
You know, but it's more educational this way. I guess
it's a documentary, so there's or in their head.
I think we should make it a fellowship requirement to watch Stissel.
Yes,
yeah, I love that show. My mom loved that show.
Which one?
My dad loved Stissel.
Yeah, it's not for everyone, but
no. I just
loved it.
Me too. It was just so, Rabbi Penny. Right, guys, take a 2-minute break.
All right.
It's 9:20. I want to get you guys out of here because it's. Let me just have a start. Is that all right? Or you want to?
No.
I gotta wait. What
are you doing,
John?
Yeah.
Hot yoga.
He's doing hot yoga
by myself.
Are you going out for a smoothie afterwards?
Let's go. We're gonna get you out of 10.